Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. After millions of acres have been consumed by sprawling development, many are calling for a new vision of land use in America. Former U.S. Secretary of the Interior Bruce Babbitt now lays out that vision in his new book, Cities in the Wilderness, and we'll talk with him about it today on Smart City. Also with us is Laurel Dukart. Laurel is attempting to re-engage high school dropouts in school through an innovative program called Gateway to College. It has attracted funding from many of America's high-profile foundations, including the Gates Foundation. New approaches to the thorny issues of land use and high school dropouts is our topic today on Smart City. But first, this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Cities in the Wilderness is Bruce Babbitt's new book that suggests a new vision of land use in America. Bruce Babbitt served as U.S. Secretary of the Interior from 1993 to 2001. He was governor of Arizona for 9 years and now practices law in Washington, D.C. Why do we need a new vision of land use in America?
The basic reason is that our current policies are not working. I mean, look up and down the Atlantic coast. Southern California, the city that you live in, sprawl is totally out of control, consuming the landscape, degrading the quality of life, both in the cities and the patterns of the natural world.
Tell me why the current vision no longer works. We've been living with this for many years now. Have we reached a breaking point? Has something happened that is now focusing our attention on this?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. Certainly, the growing population, the tendency to spread out was accelerated by the construction of the interstate highway system, the easy access of automobile transportation. It began, of course, back in the 50s, probably after World War II, but it has certainly accelerated. I mean, if you look at the east coast of the United States, we virtually have a linear city now that runs from Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, and headed all the way down toward Richmond, Virginia. And local governments, cities and counties, just seem kind of powerless to resist the developers who are saying, just one more won't make any difference, and if you don't let us do what we want, we'll go somewhere else and we'll take the development there. And it just becomes a kind of irresistible machine consuming land, forests, water resources, degrading both the landscape and the communities that we live in.
Do you think the pain is now felt pain among citizens? In other words, do you think there is a growing appetite among the public for a new approach to land use, for saying no?
It's bringing up, I think, all over the country. You can see it in your own community. And it's taking really interesting forms. In California, for example, local communities are pushing initiatives which basically take the power away from local officials. Some California counties, for example, say, you want a new development, what we call a greenfield development, you know, on previously undeveloped land, you got to put it on the ballot at the general election, and the voters will, having lost all confidence in the planning and zoning process, we're going to have the final say. You see similar movements cropping up in Arizona, which is really a Phoenix area, kind of sprawl city. A lot of local sort of grassroots efforts to contain this process and to find ways to set aside open space, even voting bond issues for that purpose.
How much of this response, this grassroots reaction you're speaking of, is a wise reaction, in your opinion, and how much of it is just, I've got mine now, you stay where you are? Because there's always been this resistance, for instance, to density, which you would probably say density is a good thing because it conserves land. So how much of this is informed resistance, in your opinion?
Certainly some of it is so-called NIMBY syndrome. I'm here, and now I don't want anybody in my backyard. But I think it's broader than that. You know, people who are stuck in commuter hour traffic for an hour, hour and a half, even 2 hours, are beginning to wonder why it is we can't develop in more rational patterns that allocate jobs and living and access to cultural facilities in a more rational way. And I think much of that is behind the local land trust movement, where people are really in vast numbers of local communities now saying we want to protect open space and we're willing to pay the price to do that.
Do you think this hurricane season that has been so devastating has brought new focus to the issues of environmental degradation that results from poor land use?
Well, I think Katrina really is a wake-up call. It's not just New Orleans, which I think inevitably is going to have to be rebuilt as sort of on the model of Venice as an island city, because rising sea levels, the sinking delta, are going to put vast areas of South Louisiana underwater. It's a striking fact that half the people in Louisiana, a state with a population of about 5 million people, half of them live less than 3 feet above sea level. Now, I think that fact, when put up against the fact that those delta areas are naturally sinking, they've been deprived of the sediment source that used to sort of build the delta to offset the sinking. When you add global warming and a rise in sea level of consensus estimate now is a couple feet in this coming century, we've got a land use planning issue. Where are those 2.5 million people going to go, and when are we going to start getting serious about a national policy which incentivizes and helps state and local governments to make sensible decisions?
In fact, you write about your failure to make any headway in changing land use in the Mississippi River Basin in your book, Cities in the Wilderness. What were the political obstacles you encountered there?
Land use has traditionally been heavily local, and states are just now, I think, kind of learning the tremendous importance of this. And we've had some success stories in New Jersey, in Oregon, in Florida. But there was a huge flood. I think many people remember back in 1993, the upper Mississippi River Valley was enormously flooded and overwhelmed. The proper response would have been to put together an interstate river management plan to manage the waters. That was kind of a bridge too far. I mean, we're working kind of at the state level now, and the idea of bringing states together, it has yet to be accomplished very effectively. You see it with Katrina, where Louisiana and Mississippi, two states side by side, have very common problems with the management of that coastal resource. But you'd think they were two separate countries in terms of their inability to talk to each other or have any kind of joint plan.
Well, this is part of the problem that you describe in your book, the need to operate at eco-scale, which doesn't respect state boundaries or any other boundaries for that matter, political boundaries, and of course our governance, which is simply not operating at eco-scale. First of all, explain what you mean by eco-scale.
Basically, it means you look at units of land that are geographically and biologically related. The most obvious way to sort of think of that is in terms of river basins. The river in your neighborhood is connected upstream to tributaries and downstreams to larger rivers. And what we do on one parcel of land affects everyone in the basin. Again, going back to Katrina, the most interesting example of that is that the destruction of New Orleans really began almost 100 years ago in Montana. Now, you know, Montana is 2,000 miles away from New Orleans, and you may say, well, what's the connection? The connection is the Corps of Engineers began building dams on the upper Missouri River in Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, and those dams have trapped all of the sediment that gave rise to the name Big Muddy for the river. And that sediment is, in fact, what was deposited down in the delta around New Orleans, keeping that land above sea level. So the failure to think about the entire river system led to isolated decisions that seemed to make sense for Montana, but which were effectively, over time, a death warrant for New Orleans.
Well, you mentioned the Corps of Engineers. Is the Corps of Engineers part of the problem or part of the solution?
Well, they're kind of a chameleon-like organization, some of both. They really gained their present size after the great Mississippi River flood of 1927. The Corps was kind of given this mission to build levees, to do flood control. A lot of that has been necessary, but they become such a powerful bureaucratic organization that they've kind of gone on and on and on and on to the point that it's now, in many cases, not necessary and destructive. The Corps of Engineers has a flood control project in every congressional district in the United States. And the reason is, you know, it's bureaucratically simple. Pork barrel public works have been popular. The local congressman supports it, and pretty soon their budgets are bulletproof in the United States Congress. And during my tenure in office, we got the Corps together to do some very good things in Florida by way of revitalizing and restoring river systems, tearing out unnecessary levees, and beginning to reestablish the original patterns of these flows of water across the land. But I would say in most places they're still in the old mode of saying this river is best if we eliminate the floodplain, dredge it, channel it, and turn it into a stagnant canal rather than a live river.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Bruce Babbitt. He is former Secretary of the Interior during the Clinton administration, former governor of Arizona, and author of the new book, Cities in the Wilderness, A New Vision of Land Use in America. You talked about the work you did in Florida, and in contrast to the lack of progress you complained about in the Mississippi River Basin, you really made some progress in the Florida Everglades. Talk about that. Why were you able to do that?
To be really honest and factually correct, one reason we were able to make so much progress in Florida is because we had something to work from. A really interesting story. Back in 1928, there was a huge hurricane that came in off the Atlantic and took aim, in this case, not at Lake Pontchartrain, that's in Louisiana, but at Lake Okeechobee, which is a huge, shallow inland lake in central Florida. The lake broke over its banks, and before it was all over, 2,000 or 3,000 people had drowned, and the state was a mess. They responded by building a bigger levee. Then another hurricane came along 20 years later, and of course hurricanes, you can't program them to go the same way twice. The next one ignores the lake, but wrecks another part of central Florida, which was under, you know, 2-3 feet of water. And in the wake of that, Florida and the United States Congress, back in the late 1940s, put together a land plan for all of South Florida, sort of visualizing the land as appropriate places for agriculture, for water storage. They created Everglades National Park down at the bottom, set up urban protection boundaries around the coastal cities, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and the other Atlantic cities. And it was that land use plan which has really prevented the Katrina kind of damage in Florida. So that's what we had to work with when we started. And our job in the Clinton administration was really about fine-tuning that and putting the natural functioning of the water system in a little stronger position on a landscape where, importantly, the people of Florida had come to accept two important things. One, that you needed, in order to protect against natural disaster and to have, you know, to protect natural features, you needed a large-scale land use plan. And secondly, that the best way to do that was to do it in partnership with the federal agencies, and particularly the Corps of Engineers. That's what's missing in Louisiana, and it's the reason for the catastrophe down there, and it's the reason that to this day, 2 months after that hurricane, we haven't made any progress down there. The national leaders are silent on this issue. The Congress is procrastinating, turning it into a political football. The local leaders don't seem to quite have it together, and it stands in stark contrast to the quality of the leadership in Florida historically. I mean, not just today, but for the last 50 years.
How do you change that? Is it simply a lack of recognition of the significance of land use, or is it just indifference, or is it bowing to special interest? What's at work there?
We live in a kind of a discouraging time. The environment doesn't seem to be front and center in the Congress. Our national leadership is working actually to undo and water down the existing environmental laws, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the ones that have served us so well. There is, I think, a countervailing trend starting to take place at the local level. We talked about that at the beginning of this discussion. There really is, I think, a sense beginning to grow in communities that something is wrong, that we could be doing a much better job, and I think that there's a good chance. This democracy we live in ultimately change as a function of what happens at the grassroots. I think that's starting. But the point I make in this book is we really do need national leadership, and we need a stronger national vision of how we empower and incentivize state and local governments. Just to give you one example, we have an interstate highway system, which is, of course, the advance agent of sprawl. Sprawl follows roads. Roads are the spearhead of this kind of problem. The Congress, a couple months ago, appropriated $315 billion to build more roads as part of these huge federal subsidies for this sprawl development. Those kinds of appropriations, I think, are really a chance for people to start demanding that states, as a condition of getting that kind of money to further this kind of sprawl development, ought to have and ought to be required to have land use plans and watershed protection plans to balance the development with space and ecosystem protection.
But as you said, today there's not a lot of support in our federal government for these kinds of concerns. You mentioned the real action is at the grassroots level, and at the same time, as you said, we need eco-scale solutions, we need interstate solutions, we need to understand that we can't fix this problem simply at the local level. Are there nonprofit organizations? Are there other kinds of national coalition-building groups that you think are in a position to put forth the kind of vision you think we need in America to solve some of these problems?
Well, I'm hopeful. I see the beginnings of it out there. It's obviously not going to happen tomorrow. Just to give you one example, I think the most dynamic of all of these local groups are these local land trusts. There's one probably in virtually every community in the United States. They start with people watching the space disappearing in their neighborhood. And they tend to scale up into nonprofits, NGOs as they're known, which begin looking at how to influence planning, how to contain growth, how to acquire open space by sponsoring bond issues for acquisition, by urging landowners to donate conservation easements, by intervening in the local planning and zoning commissions. And that's a start. But they are never going to make it unaided because the forces of development are being spearheaded by the national government, which is busy erasing all these efforts by appropriating money for interstate highway building, for local road building, for work by the Corps of Engineers. And ultimately, the two kind of have to come together, and this grassroots kind of momentum has got to be translated into making the federal government not the enemy, but a partner, saying not only do you subsidize development, but you must provide incentives to require the protection of open space and watersheds and river basins.
As in anything, there are trade-offs between environmental concerns and at least near-term economic gain. For instance, in your book, you advocate dam removal, but some of those dams produce power. How do you weigh the trade-offs?
I think trade-off is a little misleading, because that suggests that you can only have one at the expense of the other. I think one reason this is sprawl process has been so hard to contain is because the development community has effectively phrased it that way. It's in their interest to say, well, you can have open space or development. You can't have both. We can have both. There's plenty of space in every community in this country to develop, to grow, to have an economy that's vibrant, and to protect open space. You do need economic analysis, and of course, the dam removal is, as you suggest, an example of that. Dams provide benefits, hydroelectric power in most cases, navigation in a few cases, and recreation. But the fact is that we've just gone overboard. Dam building became such a popular kind of pork barrel process in the short term. You spend a lot of federal money and create jobs, and they don't think about the long-term benefits versus ecological costs. We've got 75,000 dams in this country. My own guess is that 10% of them, any rational analysis would say that they should come down. Many of them are no longer producing power. Many of them are full of sediments. Many of them have destroyed really important salmon runs in the Pacific Northwest, the fish runs on the Atlantic. That movement is just beginning. It's part of this idea of restoration. You don't have to accept everything that's been developed and put on the land. Dams are not the pyramids of Egypt.
We had a guest on the program recently who talked about the transportation bill and said something that really stuck with me. He said that since we've completed the interstate highway system, we've never replaced that with a new vision for transportation. Therefore, you get 6,000 earmarks in the transportation bill. No one knows what it is we're trying to achieve. So without a national vision for land use, isn't the only alternative pork barrel because we don't know what we're trying to achieve?
Well, I think it's exactly right. All it is just money being sprinkled across the construction industry, the highway lobby, and state and local officials. That's certainly the case with water development, Corps of Engineers, Bureau of Reclamation, the Interstate Highway Program. The Interstate Highway Program, in its initial formulation, was a very interesting case of federally directed land use planning, because it was clear in the 1950s that we needed a national highway system, and the original bills basically said to the states, we're going to put together a system, and we can't have 50 states with 50 different highway systems. And under federal leadership, we put together a system that made a lot of sense. The money was applied in a rational way. Those days are gone. It's now just we have slipped back into this random road building. Mind you, the time is now at hand for looking seriously at mass transit that's beginning to come, and it has real implications for land use planning. But we're in a slack stage now in which the money is there, but it's basically pork for development.
We only have a minute or two left, but for those who support your argument, which policies and investments should they be focused on and supporting?
You know, it reminds me of when Willie Sutton was asked why he robs banks. His answer was, because that's where the money is. And I think that's equally true of the federal budget in terms of land use and changing the way we appropriate money to condition it upon rational plans. You got to go where the big bucks are, and that's the highway system. It's water development. A lot of the energy bills have turned into pure pork, and there's a planning element in the way we develop energy infrastructure. Those are all important things. And I guess my last piece of advice to people who are concerned about this is all real change has to be rooted in grassroots action. And therefore, you know, begin thinking of your local land use planning commission, about these land trust organizations, and about ways that you can be heard and organized in numbers to start to make real change.
The book is Cities in the Wilderness, A New Vision of Land Use in America. The author is Bruce Babbitt. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
Bruce Babbitt's new book is Cities in the Wilderness, A New Vision of Land Use in America. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about community leadership and where it will come from. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk with Laurel Dukehart about her success in getting dropouts back in school. You're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he provides us with urban insights from around the country. Otis, you and I have talked before about the dearth of business leadership in communities for a lot of reasons, and you've particularly focused recently on where did all the bankers go?
This is a very, very big topic, much discussed, although people really don't have much of a way of getting into the topic. But when you do get into it, most people who are active in civic work nod their heads because they realize this is a problem. Let me give you a little personal background, and it might illustrate what I'm about to say. When I was a business reporter in the late 1970s and early 1980s, one of my assignments was to do profiles of various cities and what was it like to do business in these places. And I worked out a shortcut after a while. I'd pick up, whenever I was to go someplace where I didn't really know anyone, New Orleans or Charlotte or somewhere like that, I'd pick up the bank directory, and there is a directory of banks all across the United States. I'd pick up the bank directory, and I'd look to see which was the largest bank or two in the city. Then I'd look for the CEO's name, and I'd call, and if I could get through to the CEO of whatever the largest bank was in the city and could get an appointment with that person, he could tell me, or she could tell me, but mostly it was he, could tell me everything that was going on, because bankers were that central to the life of business communities in these cities. They were the ones who headed the chambers of commerce. They were the ones who raised money for United Way. They were the ones who campaigned for bond referenda. They were at the center of things. And I would say that 9 out of 10 times, the biggest bank tended to have the biggest civic leader in the community. Today, I would say that it's probably 9 out of 10 chances that the biggest bank, the person who is the head of the biggest bank in town, is not one of the leading civic leaders there. Typically, these people today, they've only been in town for 2 or 3 years, they really don't know the community very well, and they're going to be moving on for another couple of years. The reason for all of this, of course, is that we've had this tremendous consolidation in the banking industry. Back in the 70s and 80s, every city had two or three very big locally owned banks. And today, most of those big cities have lost their locally owned banking institutions. And it's not just places like Fort Worth, Texas, or Richmond, or somewhere like that. It's really, really big cities do not have locally owned banks anymore that are substantial players there. Los Angeles doesn't, Boston doesn't, Houston doesn't. So they've been replaced by these national chains like Bank of America or Chase or Wachovia. One business leader I know in Dallas refers to them as drive-by executives, the people who kind of come to be CEOs of these places. And now it's not to criticize them as bankers, because I think probably these big national banks do a better job of the banking part of their jobs. It's just that they're mostly absent on the civic end of what they used to do, and we just don't have that critical piece of civic leadership anymore.
So who is taking their place?
Well, that's a really good question, and we really don't know. I don't think anybody's ever taken a really close look at what the national patterns are. But my guess would be we're seeing sort of more professionalization of leadership. That is, Chamber of Commerce executives are more in the leadership roles that the big bankers would have played 20 years ago. We're also seeing some well-motivated sort of mid-sized business CEOs, people who have spent all their life in a community who want to contribute. And we're seeing a lot of erosion in the business community's influence on things. It's moving more toward neighborhoods and elected officials these days.
It was interesting to see the recent announcement of Google, the creation of the foundation there. What are they focusing on? Global poverty and environmental issues. Again, operating at a global scale with their philanthropy, which, Otis, what, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, was very rare.
Yeah. It's kind of the same thing you see with Bill Gates. He's a little bit more generous with the Seattle area, but most of his work has been in global stuff. And part of that's the nature of the high-tech industry. And part of it is simply the global nature of these companies, including the banks these days. They do operate in communities, but their CEOs think globally these days in a way that the old CNS Bank here in Atlanta or the old Bank of Boston or Security Pacific in L.A., they didn't think. They thought more regionally, and that made them perfect leaders in their day and in that place.
This won't be the last discussion we have on this issue, because it is fast-changing and still, as you say, a bit of an unexplored mystery.
We'll figure it out.
Well, that would be great. We could do a service to everyone. Otis, I'll talk to you next week.
Okay, Carol.
Thanks. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Laurel Dukart pioneered new techniques for getting high school dropouts back in school at Portland Community College's PrEP Alternative Program. She's now spreading what she learned there as manager of the Gateway to College Replication. With her husband, Joe Courtwright, she co-founded Impresa Consulting in Portland, and she's a veteran of the aerospace and metals industries. Laurel, no one has an accurate number, but what are the estimates for the percentage of students entering ninth grade who drop out of high school before graduation?
We say that it's about one-third nationally, but unfortunately in cities and for students of color, that number is really closer to 50% who don't achieve a diploma by the time they finish what would be their senior year of high school.
That's an astounding number. Does the percentage vary widely among school systems?
It does, and, you know, unfortunately, there's not one way that everyone calculates dropout percentages mm-hmm. the same, so that makes it really difficult to put your finger on a number, but nobody says that it's not a crisis. There's agreement that it's definitely a crisis across the country. We know that with changing demographics, we need all of our young people, and to say that a third of them won't achieve a diploma is just really not good enough.
It's interesting. Conversation about this problem seems to come and go, but the problem remains. Why do you think this is a problem that just doesn't hit the radar screen and stick with urban policymakers and decision makers?
Well, I think everyone knows that education is really in a tough spot right now. All school districts are clamoring for more resources, and to try to say, you know, here's another huge problem for you to fix, just makes everyone extremely frustrated when they know that they're working really hard. I think one of the important things to focus on is that there's probably not a fix for our large comprehensive high schools that will solve this problem for all students. One of the reasons so many young people drop out is that they just have a lot of challenges in their life that get in the way. What we're finding in our research is pretty surprising. Students don't really drop out of high school, generally speaking, because of the academic challenge. It's because their families are moving. They've become homeless. They have health issues. They feel bullied at their school, and they, a lot of them say, just can't stand the drama of high school.
That's an interesting point you make. In some ways, it's hard to believe, because if you believe the number that one-third of our students are dropping out, one-half of the students of color, and that academic challenge is not a big part of that problem, I mean, it's just, it's hard to fathom. But you say, really, most of the problem lies elsewhere.
Right. And, of course, they're not achieving good grades. And so if you looked at their report card, you would see an academic problem for sure. Attendance and low grades are typical with students who leave school. But I think we need to dig deeper and look at the reasons why they're not attending. And it might be interesting to share some statistics. We survey students who come into Gateway to College right when they start into the program. And we've replicated around the country and are open in 5 states right now. And so we have taken a look at what the profile of the students are coming into the program in those 5 states. In fact, we give them a list of problems to talk about on the survey, and 87% of all these students select 3 or more of these big problems, and almost half, 49%, select 6 or more of these problems. These are things like homelessness, problems with the juvenile justice system, being in foster care and moving from home to home, drug and alcohol issues.
You mentioned Gateway to College, so let's back up and talk about that. Tell me about the program that you run.
Gateway to College is a really innovative opportunity for young people who've left high school without a diploma to reengage with education at the community college setting. They come in, and because of a dual credit, a curriculum alignment, they can take courses and earn high school credit and college credit. So the students can finish their diploma at the community college while earning a significant number of college credits and even achieving an associate's degree at the same time. Students can go part-time. They can go at night or even on the weekends. So it's a great alternative for kids who just can't sit in the classroom for 6 hours a day. Teen parents, kids who have to work. It just provides them not only a more flexible environment, but an environment that's, I think, more welcoming to a real diverse group of young people.
Well, that makes sense. And, of course, our young people are increasingly diverse. So one of the questions I have, Laurel, is if this is working with dropouts, why shouldn't it work with kids who are staying in school, especially if I can earn high school and college credit at the same time? Why not do that and reduce the cost and the length of my education?
Gateway to College is part of an initiative that's really trying to do that. It's called the Early College High School Initiative. It's funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and some other sponsors. And what they're really trying to do is blur the lines between high school and college and to reach out to underrepresented populations to make sure that they not only get that degree, but believe that they can go to college and succeed in college. Gateway to College is unique as a part of that initiative because we're working with dropouts. But I want to make it clear that we're not encouraging any young people to leave school. We think if a student is succeeding in a traditional comprehensive high school, that that's great and that's where they should stay. But that for a certain group of students that are not likely to ever really make that work for them, we just need to have another choice. Our program isn't even the right one for all dropouts because students need to have an 8th grade reading level in order to get in, because it is a college program and we want to set them up to be successful. So cities really need to look at what is their range of alternative programs, what kinds of options exist within the regular school district setting so that it meets the needs of all the different students that they're trying to help.
I'm jumping ahead here, but I think back to my senior year in high school, and I definitely stayed 1 year too long. I was horribly unchallenged the last year, and I was a good student. So I can imagine that this would be a good option for many bright students, except A, I have to be labeled, I guess, a dropout, and 2, community college was not necessarily my ambition. Have you had that issue come up at all?
Community colleges already offer a lot of different choices for young people who are doing well in school. They offer advanced placement courses, high school completion. Most community colleges have a lot of different opportunities for young people. I work at Portland Community College, and I know that we have handfuls of programs that work with young people. Again, I think the important thing is finding the right match for the students' needs. Gateway to College is a program that offers a lot of student support. We have wraparound services for students because they have come to us with so many challenges and often may have never had an adult in their life that really believes in their academic potential. We really think that the wraparound support is what helps make our program so successful. But it is more expensive. Comprehensive high school in most cities today, a counselor might have 400 to 500 or even more students that they're trying to take care of. And in our program, we keep that at about 50 students for one resource specialist. That person acts as their coach, mentor, the class advisor, connecting them to resources outside of the college. So for a lot of young people that have really challenging family situations or are independent, that kind of support is absolutely essential to them being able to succeed in college. I mentioned a survey a few minutes ago of our students, and another really amazing statistic is that 7% of the young people that we're working with said that one of the reasons they had to drop out of high school was homelessness. So, you know, these are young people that are really struggling. We've had students trying to attend college living in cars. An awful lot of the young people that we work with, even though they may be 16 or 17, are living independently. They're not supported by family members. And that even includes grandparents or sisters and brothers. We've tried to take a pretty global look at that.
And you mentioned wraparound services. Is that the way you describe the resource specialist? Or is it something
Yes.
more than that, Laurel?
The resource specialist also teaches some courses when a student begins in the program. We call it a cohort term because all of the students are working together with their age peers, taking some college development courses to get ready to become successful college students. And the resource specialist teaches counseling and guidance courses to help them learn how to be successful students. They're doing things like helping them with time management, motivation, being accountable. I kind of say it's a lot like tough love. They're providing support and telling them that these young students can do anything they set their mind to, but they also have to take responsibility. And for a lot of them, the behaviors that they had in high school weren't really leaning toward their academic success, and they need to learn some new coping habits. So that's one of the things the resource specialists try to help them do in order to develop good habits to be good students.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Laurel Dukehart. She's manager of Gateway to College and the replication of that program around the country.
Gateway to College was developed at Portland Community College here in Oregon, and because it was a unique way to reengage young people who'd left without a diploma, it caught the attention of the Gates Foundation, and they provided $10.2 million to the college to fund startup at 17 more sites around the country. We work with young people 16 until they turn 21. And so a lot of times if you have someone who's 19 or 20, terribly behind in credits, unlikely to graduate, some of them are English language learners who are immigrants, it's not a great fit for them to go back to a traditional high school. So we have this funding in order to work with college and K-12 partners who want to figure out a way to offer a program to help students who have dropped out complete their diploma, but also get those important college credits so that they can move on and achieve an associate's degree or even a bachelor's degree.
Where are you currently working?
We have 9 sites so far, and they're all in different states. We have 2 sites that are just starting their second year with students. One is in Riverside, California. The other is in Montgomery County, Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C. We just started with 3 new sites this year. They just started in fall term. One is called Clackamas Community College. It's in Oregon City, Oregon. We also have Georgia Perimeter College. They are in Decatur, Georgia, just outside of Atlanta. And Palo Alto College. They are in San Antonio, Texas. Those sites are all open and working with students. We're just announcing now 4 new sites that are going into training, and they'll be starting to serve students next fall. And those include the Community College of Philadelphia, Tri-County Technical College in South Carolina, and Mount Wachusett's College in Gardner, Massachusetts, which is outside of Boston.
And typically, your partners in a city, obviously a community college must be a partner. Do you have other partners?
Yes, the school districts are essential because this program uses K-12 money to pay for the students' tuition and books.
Okay.
So what we're really looking for is a strong partnership and an interest in working with these young people. Often it's more than one school district working with the college, come together to figure out a plan to overcome some of the policy barriers around doing dual credit programs like this. It's very possible, but sometimes you have to think a little bit outside the box to make dual credit work. Other partners that are important, you know, the more the better. This is really important work There's all kinds of reasons why cities need to re-engage these young people. So if business is at the table, if workforce programs are at the table, that's all a bonus. And strong partnerships are one of the most important things to make it work.
I want to talk a little bit about the money. You said that essentially K through 12 money is used for, you said books and tuition.
Tuition.
And so, and I assume you get the average per pupil expenditure or nothing more from a K through 12 district. Would that be correct?
That's generally how it works. Every place that we've replicated has done it a slightly different way, but I think that's the easiest way to understand it. And that money is passed through to the college. Generally, the school district keeps a little bit for administration and transcripting. Testing is another big challenge with all of the emphasis on high-stakes exit exams now. So they work together to figure out how to support the students. But the per-pupil expenditure pays for the tuition at the college and the books. One of the things that's really great about this program is that it's economical and sustainable because the students are taking regular college classes with the adult learning population at the college. The only special classes that they take are in their first term when they're taught by special gateway to college instructors who are getting ready to take the regular classes with the adult population. So they're really trying to understand where the students have been in the high school world and where they need to go in the college world and get them ready to be successful students.
You said it costs a little more to operate this program than your typical high school would pay per pupil. Is that correct?
Yes and no. I did say that, and what I was thinking when I said it is that, you know, we do have these resource specialists that support the student throughout their time in the program. That can be anywhere from 1 to 3 years, depending on how many credits they come into the program with. We're only able to use K-12 dollars to fund them until they either earn their diploma or turn 21. In most states, it's 21. Some places, it's 20. And unfortunately, in some states, it's just not possible to re-enroll students and serve them, give them a little bit more time to get that diploma. So that's one of the things that has to be in place in order to make this model work in various cities.
And, of course, there's no calculation made at all of the cost of dropouts to a community,
well,
which is huge.
That is a really important point. I like to think about what's the cost of not re-engaging them. Obviously, unemployment, social services, incarceration, a less qualified workforce. I think it's really important that we start taking a look at what it costs to let a third of our young people not even finish a high school diploma, which for the most part is only opening the door to the skills and the credentials that they need to have a good job.
Well, I want to stay one more minute with this money question. Is it
typically
cheaper, Laurel, to educate someone in high school or in community college?
Well, I don't think I know
community
the
college. The reason I'm curious is, again, if you can educate high school students in community college and do it cheaper, then you would think from a public policy standpoint we would do that. On the other hand, of course, if you can educate a child cheaper in high school than in community college, we ought to fix high school so that we can do that. I'm just wondering how the money compares and shakes out. If you don't know it, it would be an interesting question to explore, wouldn't it?
Well, it is an interesting question to explore. The challenge is that there's probably not going to be a single answer. Every place does funding a little bit different. Some of the colleges that I'm working with, they actually have caps. So enrolling a new student does not turn on a spigot of any new money to support that student. Other places, there are difficulties with blending funds from the K-12 side and the college side to support students. So it's really pretty complicated. In every different place, I can think of different examples of how trying to get to that number would be pretty difficult.
But, of course, it's all our money. So even though someone slices and dices it, it's all our money. So someone should put those numbers together, and it shouldn't. They should flow to wherever they are effectively used and efficiently used.
I think you're right. I think we really need to start looking at education as a seamless system from K through 20 and think about what does it take to get young people the credentials they need to be part of a qualified workforce, and that the siloing of funds is one of the biggest problems in trying to do something innovative like this.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what you run into as you go from city to city.
That's right.
Here's a question that's way too sweeping, but I'm going to ask it of you anyway. What is the quality of community college education in America today?
Well, as I've traveled around the country, I've been amazed at how wonderful the programs are that I'm looking at, there's just this great dedication to trying to really work with the community. I think a lot of colleges take that title very much to heart. Of course, I'm sure that there are some colleges out there that have a lower quality than what we'd like to see, but I am certainly impressed as I travel around the country and talk with people. They have to be all things to all people. Community colleges are offering college transfer programs to get students ready to go to four-year universities. They're doing workforce training. They're working with English language learners. Interesting kinds of programs like mine that are working with younger people and community education. And they're also retraining laid-off workers. They really have a broad set of initiatives on their plate. And I think they're doing a really great job.
If Gateway to College is successful, how long will it take for us to begin seeing results?
Right now, we know that we will have served about 5,500 students by the time that the 17 sites have been funded and started up through Gateway to College, through our startup funds that we're allowed to provide to people. But then the great thing is that the budgets for these programs are all sustainable, so they'll continue to enroll up to 200 students every year. I'm hoping that that is just what is a catalyst to begin a lot more work in other cities. We have a lot more interest than I have the ability to fund startup programs. Some of the places where I'm going are talking about how to use state funds or think outside the box in order to try to start up programs like Gateway to College without philanthropic dollars, and I think that's really exciting. Looking at things like lottery-funded scholarships, maybe a weighted per pupil expenditure to K-12 to help work with the harder to serve student or the student who needs to take a little bit longer or go in a different environment. So I think the long-term impact of doing this, it's hard to measure, but I think it's going to be really amazing. There's so much interest. Just last week, I was with the director of the program, Gateway to College at PCC, talking with the American Youth Policy Forum about the interest in trying to do alternative education, kind of a menu of choices in various cities. And I think that the interest is so strong right now to figure out what to do about this dropout problem and to look globally at what types of services need to be out there to give students a second chance. Our slogan at PCC is any door is the right door to college. And I think it's going to take a lot of doors, but I think that the more that communities see other people doing interesting things and having success, it's just kind of having a snowball effect.
Well, with a third of our students dropping out, we need you to be successful, and I hope that you are. Laurel, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Laurel Dukehart is the manager of the Gateway to College replication. You're listening to Smart City. City View's commentator Walker Smith joins us weekly to give us his very personal view of life in cities.
Trust in American society is as low as it has ever been, particularly trust in institutions. An October 2005 survey by the Pew Center for the People and the Press found precipitous declines in the trust people have in the federal government and Congress, along with notable drops in trust for the military and both political parties. Trust in business was the lowest tracked by Pew in two decades. Other research conducted by Dan Yankelovich has found that trust in business is now as low as it was in the 70s. Institutional mistrust waxes and wanes, but Yankelovich argues that it is worse now because recent scandals have exposed abuses of trust that took place behind the late 90s moralistic facade of shareholder value. This pretense has made the ensuing outrage that much fiercer and less forgiving. The former MIT Business School dean, Glenn Urban, believes that the contemporary distrust of business is so widespread and deep-seated that an entirely new business model is required, something he refers to as trust-based marketing. For Urban, this means that businesses must practice customer advocacy by putting the interest of consumers ahead of their own interest. Paradoxically, he argues that the best way for a company to advance its own interest is to make them a secondary concern. Dan Yankelovich believes in much the same thing. He calls for a shift in business norms and a new appreciation of the notion of enlightened self-interest, in which doing good means doing well. Yankelovich argues that stock market valuations support this mandate, which is more than the tired old concept of corporate social responsibility. It is essentially Urban's notion of reversing the priority of interest. This overarching environment of institutional distrust and misplaced obligations and responsibilities seems to have spread. A May survey by the Pew Internet and American Life Project found that only 32% believe that most people can be trusted. In the 2004 General Social Survey, only 37% agreed. A September Gallup poll found 45%. By whatever measure, well over half of us distrust other people. Our communities cannot long survive, much less thrive, in this atmosphere of suspicion and distrust. If misgivings and mistrust color our feelings towards others, then, as Dan Yankelovich says, we will not give anyone or any institution the benefit of the doubt. This poisons our relationships and corrupts our affairs. And it takes a bite out of our pocketbooks, too, as we spend more to protect ourselves and avoid disappointments. Certainly, it would be an overstatement to suggest that our communities are in disillusion. Indeed, the irony is that there has been a revival of interest in community even as trust has plummeted. But the essential foundation of faith, hope, and shared interest is being steadily eroded by the institutional and interpersonal distrust now pervasive throughout American society. The answer for us as individuals is much the same as it is for institutions. We must put others first if we want to get the best for ourselves. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City broadcast, sign up for our podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music provided by Christopher Reyes. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.